Welcome back to another episode of Dan Has a Plan, Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a certified financial planner on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. Our branch is located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Hey, everyone.
Our guest today is Scott Bracken and his son, Scott Daniel Bracken. Scott and his son have shared a passion for restoring antique cars, and they're here to talk about the unique alternative investment. They are not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and their views are their own.
We're talking cars, muscle cars.
And they're going to teach us all about it.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we start with an Ask Dan question?
I'm ready.
Dun, 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 dun. This listener says, Dan, I inherited my grandfather's classic Corvette. What do I do with it? Worth keeping as far as alternative assets go?
The question is a great one, and the answer is maybe.
Yeah, always. I feel like it's often a firm maybe.
Yeah, so when it comes to classic cars, okay, there's always books you can look up the value of a vehicle, but serendipitously, we're having a podcast with two very educated men in this area. And I go to go-to people when it comes to that. I call someone that has a good history. For example, I have a client that has owned many Corvettes and he knows the market for them, both young and old. So he would probably be my first call. So you want to establish what the value of this vehicle is first.
Yeah, so it also sounds like maybe, maybe not. I don't have a ton of details on this question, but thank you for writing in. I think if this listener has no experience with cars, I'm not saying they do or don't, but if they have no experience, what kind of costs are associated with this inheritance?
Great question. So the second call would be to someone who is in the area of fixing these types of vehicles and maintaining them.
Restoring.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't think it's a far-fetched to say that maintaining a Toyota Camry versus a high-performance Chevrolet Corvette, there's different costs associated with that.
Yep. And then also, like, where are you going to keep it? That could be another cost.
Where are you going to keep it? And let's not forget insurance.
Yeah. So we mentioned this in the episode briefly, but talk a little bit about the difference between regular insurance and classic car insurance.
Well, regular insurance is basically you're driving the vehicle as your everyday vehicle. So at a very minimum, you want to have full liability coverage on the vehicle. If the vehicle has any value, and I'm talking about value greater than $10,000, that's using my rule of thumb, I would definitely recommend having collision on the vehicle as well. Because even if you're in a minor accident, to replace parts from an older vehicle could be ultra expensive. So insurance is important.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of like other things you could inherit, where does this fall on like a money value?
It's a big business. It's a big asset class. I have run across numerous clients that have family members that have historic vehicles or vehicles that are worth great deals of money. It's a great question. Personally, I don't recommend to clients that they have this as an asset class. Usually the asset class is created by a passion, and passion sometimes crosses into value.
Right. You talk a little bit about it in the episode, but you want to tell us about your own personal connection to a classic car?
Well, the basic definition of a classic car is one that's greater than 25 years in age. So the
what are we working with?
We're going back to 1968. I know I was just 8 years old then when this car was manufactured, but I bought it in 1978.
Okay.
So at that point, it was 10 years old.
Okay. So not a classic.
It wasn't a classic at that point. So it was a 1968 Ford Mustang.
Color?
Red, affectionately known as the Rust Bucket.
By who?
By me. It had a 289 V8 engine. And so for those that know engines and cylinders and all that stuff, this thing had some major, major guts. How's that? It would purr.
You should go into sound effects. This was your first car purchase?
First car purchase, $800 cash. Purchased from Ron Abeling in Ilion, New York.
Shout out, Ron.
Hey, Ron. A.B. Duber, they used to call him. Anyways, he was a guy that worked with my dad. When I parted ways with the car, it was for a down payment on your mother's engagement ring.
This is famous lore in the Smith household.
Correct. And I have to say, it was very difficult for me to sell that vehicle.
Yeah.
Very difficult. And I think about it a lot. And now it's the year 2026, so we're well past
classic
1968. So this is a classic vehicle now.
Yeah.
And it's one I've been in the market for.
Yeah. And two questions. How did you feel when you first drove that car?
Wow. I remember pulling out of the driveway at 283 East Clark Street, Ilion, New York. Don't Google search that house because...
What, you're afraid of the picture?
Speaking of antique. But anyways, I remember driving down the street and wow. I know my feet weren't on the ground, but I felt like I was, you know, living a dream. Living a dream.
That's special.
You know, like a first vehicle. It's like, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah. And what made you decide to sell it for mom's engagement ring?
After college, I moved to New Jersey and, you know, it was a very high traffic area. It wasn't in the dependable range anymore as far as maintenance. And so I got a company car and it was an unneeded excess. So I wanted it to go towards something that would be meaningful. And as I tell the story, it was mom's engagement ring. And then your sister got married last year and it was transitioned to her finger. So when I look at Janine's finger, I see my old Ford Mustang. That's probably not what Janine sees. But
well, no, we never saw it. We got to find a picture of this thing.
Yeah, so we got...
No, that's so special.
Yeah, so we're going to try to dig up a picture of my Mustang.
Okay.
I'm not sure. The family wasn't big on pictures back when I... You know, the Kodak Instamatic camera was basically as high-end as you can get.
All right, I'm going to call in Sue Smith on this one. Let's see.
Exactly.
All right, well, without further ado, let's welcome our guest.
The Scott Bracken and his son, the Scott Daniel Bracken. So, Alana Jacqueline, today we are very lucky to have a father-son combination.
How apropos.
Exactly. So, Father's Day month of June, and here we go.
Also, you know, you're my father. It's a bit thematic.
It's very thematic, exactly. So, we're joined today by Scott Bracken, and we're also joined by his son, Scott Daniel Bracken.
Fantastic. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
It certainly is our pleasure. So we're going to go back in time a little bit today.
Recently, we had an episode where we talked about how expensive buying a car is.
Exactly.
We didn't want to talk about that stressful topic because everybody's stressed out about buying cars, but we wanted to talk about cars.
Yeah. So what got me thinking about it was I work with somebody at UBS and he's looking for his first vehicle. And one of the advisors in the office recommended a dealership for him to go to. And he walked into the dealership and the salesman handed him three sets of keys for F-150s. This is in the mid 70s. This is in the mid 80s. This is in the mid $90,000.
Hang on a second. What's an F-150?
It's a pickup truck.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
After the guy took one knee at the desk, after hearing the prices of these vehicles, I thought we could tie it into an episode.
Yeah. Fantastic.
So speaking of a theme, going back in time, Scott Bracken is a collector of older vehicles.
Scott, tell us all about it.
Well, it's definitely something that started when I was young, you know.
And really?
Yeah.
What's young, Scott? Give us a young.
Collecting the vehicles or loving them?
Loving them.
I can remember being 4, 5, 6, and my neighbors, I remember still to this day what cars they had. They were Stingray Corvettes. I was fascinated by it because it had a door handle that was at the top of the door.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
It dives into the top of the door sill, and it blew my mind. I used to walk to, you know, first and second grade, and I couldn't stop.
And what car did your family have?
We had a Volkswagen bus.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Like the old hippie bus?
Yeah, my father had a brand new 70, well, I say brand new, but it was like a 72 or 3 Volkswagen bus. That was the family truckster.
What color?
Red and white.
Wow. We're going Partridge Family here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is that the car you grew up with, too?
No. Would have been cool, though.
It would have been cool, definitely. My father is not mechanically sound at all. Like, he doesn't have the gift. He blew up the motor like 3 times. You know? Yeah. He's abusive on the cars. But that was back then, 1972, 73. My memories of cars, I can remember my grandparents' cars, you know, Chevy Impalas, my aunt Chevy Impala. I remember it like yesterday.
It's like dad and baseball stats.
Exactly. Everybody has their thing.
Yeah. And
I couldn't remember a baseball stat for the life of me, but I could tell you that somebody around the corner from us had a 340 Duster, and it was black with a white top and white stripes and a white interior.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you have that too?
I am the same way. From a very young age, I started out, you could show me your keys. I'm talking like a little kid sitting in the grocery store looking at people's keys. Oh, you drive a Jeep. You drive a Pontiac.
Before he could form full sentences, he would just point at somebody's key ring and mumble the car, you know. He was in the shopping cart with his legs sticking through. He was that small. People are saying, what's he saying? I said, he knows that you drive a Honda. And they were blown away.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
That's tremendous stuff.
And numbers, Dan. He would spit out numbers. He would say something like, you know, Uncle Jerry's van, yellow 5. And Doreen and I would try and figure out the puzzle. What is he saying? So we would have to call Uncle Jerry. And he said, oh, I have a yellow 5 on my inspection sticker.
Whoa.
Yeah.
This is like an attention to detail thing here.
Oh, yes. Big time. You have to have that to be a good mechanic.
Absolutely, you do. Going a little bit extra, you know, instead of being just ordinary, the little bit extra makes you extraordinary.
Tell us about how you got into being a mechanic.
Well, probably I was 13. I put a new set of brakes on my car. And it
on
was
on your car or your dad's car?
Nope, my car.
Wow, 13.
Yeah, 13. I was a little old, you know, for a first car.
What car was this?
I still have it. My 1970 Plymouth Duster.
Beautiful.
Labor of love. And I had drum brakes on it, which old school technology. And just for safety reasons, I wanted disc brakes. So I put disc brakes on it, you know, pull everything I look at. It's like a puzzle. All right. This makes this work. That's just the way I look at everything. Oh, I can figure it out. That and a little bit of YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. That is a lifesaver.
Do anything on YouTube.
Yep. Absolutely. I took it to a shop right around the corner from the house to get the wheels aligned. And my father ended up calling the shop saying, hey, do me a favor. Just check over the front end of this because my son just did this, you know, in case something was missed and this and that.
Yeah, that's a good dad that he didn't want you to know. That he called ahead of time.
Yeah, I did. And I knew that he would expect me to drive the car immediately because he doesn't have a license. He's, yep, you know, 13 years old. So I said to the guy, Dimitri was his name.
Yep.
I said, Dimitri, check over everything in the front end because my son disassembled the entire front end of this car and converted it to disc brakes and put it back together. So I'm going to be driving it.
Yeah.
He called me back. He was in amazement. He said, how old is your son? I said, 13. He said, does he want a job? And seriously, he hired him.
Oh, my God. Yep.
I had to go to my elementary school for my working papers.
Oh, this is great stuff right here.
Awesome.
So he's really been working in the shop since he was 13.
Wow.
So do you consider it work?
No, I really don't.
Anything that comes in for your purview, it's just fact-finding and it's a challenge, I guess?
It is. It can be, especially now with the newer stuff that's on the road. A lot of it has to do with electronics, mm-hmm, and digging. You have to, you know, always walk through your head like, oh, KISS, keep it simple. Most of the time, that's what it is. And that's, honestly, I enjoy it. It's fun.
So you both restore classic cars as a love, a hobby. Is the goal to keep them, to collect? How do you go about it?
We have a couple of key vehicles that will never be sold.
Okay.
All right, lay it on us. Come on, what is it?
Mine is a 1970 Dodge Challenger RTSE.
Okay.
Scott and I built the motor in that. I built it the first time. He and I built it the second time, and we restored, you know, underneath the engine compartment. I put the car together in 1995, and Scott has a 1970 Duster that he bought when he was 13. So those cars are not going anywhere.
Untouchable.
Untouchable. There is zero amount of money that would take it from me. Scott threatened me. He said I would have an accident in my sleep. if I sell the car, I'm scared. I believe him. Yeah.
So there's a couple different values I'm sensing here. Okay. So your particular vehicle on the market, what is its true value, if you had to guess?
See, I couldn't even put a number on it, to be honest with you, because
he's going sentimental right out of the way here.
Right.
Right off the bat here.
20. Not even. Yeah, I would probably 20. Say 20, but it's like, the big issue with this hobby is now all the big shows like Barrett Jackson, people have cars that, oh, it's been sitting for 40 years, but this one on TV sold for $1 million. And yeah, that's the issue to where it's like people, oh, what do you think your car's worth? I look at it, it's like, you know, 15,000, but then now everybody's got junk for like 15,000.
Yeah. The cars are 50 years old,
right?
60 years old.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm.
So quick question. Do you drive those two precious ones that you have?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I put 5,000 a year on my car.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, his car is insured with a normal automobile policy because he drives it everywhere. Mine is classic insurance, so I don't really drive it a whole lot. I take, you know, car shows. I would take my kids to the car shows that have their car seats and a pack and play in the trunk of the car. And I would set them up with chairs and we would go to car shows on weekends. I built the car, first of all, so that's
right
something that I put together. And I've always loved Chrysler muscle cars. They're referred to as Mopars.
Okay.
So I've always loved Mopars. That 1970 Duster 340, the black one with the white stripes that I remember from when I was like 5 or 6 years old. Ever since then, I've been in love with them.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like it bit me back then.
Nice.
And I bought a 71 Roadrunner out of high school that I just was in love with. And I sold it. And my wife, Doreen, who was my girlfriend at the time, went up on the trailer. I was a little bit watery-eyed.
Aww.
And she said, are you crying? And I said, well, you don't know how much it means to me.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. So these couple are not going anywhere. What's the process of acquiring a new one? And what do you do with it?
Step one, get approval from mom.
Yes.
Okay, good, good.
But I do not take money out of my savings or out of my paycheck to get another car. I've been in the hobby for so long. If somebody has even a garden tractor in their backyard and it's like an old junker and there's a collector's market for it, I'll say, don't throw it out. I'll give you $50 for it. And then I'll do that and get rid of it for sometimes $300, $500 or whatever.
Okay.
And some people just don't even know about their car. They say, I was going to junk it. And that's where I say, no, I'll take it and I'll fix it, you know, get it going and find the right people through the right avenue and send it.
So it's probably difficult for you to drive around any neighborhood without having your eyes wide open.
My head is on a swivel all the time.
Yeah. This is a gift right here, Alana.
Yeah. And is your process the same?
Pretty much. I mean, I have my car, which is my keeper. And for me, I see an old car or something mechanical that has been neglected. It's like, I want to bring it back. I want somebody to go out and enjoy it. Somebody to have memories like we had.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up with dad's car. And you can't explain the feeling to where you take something that's been sitting for years and, oh, wow, now it's running.
Yep.
Oh, it's driving. Look, it's like a new lease on life for the vehicle, as silly as it sounds.
It's funny. When you were little, we were driving in the Jersey City area and they had a junkyard and they had the fronts of cars, like the grills and the headlights and the front section of cars stacked up what seemed to be like warehouse racking out in the parking lot. And he was in like his car seat and he goes, oh, look how sad they are. And I said, what? He goes, all those faces on those cars. Yeah. And I looked over, we had quite a laugh, but yeah, that's the feeling you get. Like when I get a car, usually I'll get it to where the next person sees its potential. And then I get it good enough to where they take it from me. You know, I had a couple of cars that I like to keep, but then life gets in the way and you have to get rid of them. So my blue 70 Challenger always stays. I just got this dump truck. I don't know what we're going to do with it. But we have a 55 Ford also. I say we because they're no longer just mine, you know.
Sure.
Of course.
We're in this together. And we also have a 1970 Mercury Cougar Eliminator.
Wow.
And that's a super rare muscle car. And now that's probably our next
project. Absolutely.
Nice.
So, you know, tying it back in a little bit to, you know, kind of what my excitement for this episode was, my first car was a 1968 Ford Mustang Rust Bucket 289 engine V8 notchback red.
Listen to those stats.
Yeah. Believe it or not, just that it had a V8 and not a six cylinder probably narrows down the production numbers on it, depending on whatever options you had.
Yeah. So it was $100 cash I bought it for. My dad was a plumber. I never took to plumbing because it was massively difficult work. But this was a project where I really saw what my dad was capable of. And he said, we went down to a tin shop and we bought some for the floorboards and we riveted in. We replaced the, because you could see the floor from the, you
know. Absolutely. From there.
You know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
And I never heard of the word Bondo before. I never knew that you could paint a car. I didn't know what a spark plug was. I didn't know how to grease the axles, all these things. But the thing I remember most about the car was when I turned the engine over, oh my God, I can never get it out of my mind. I dream about it. But bottom line is, the first date I took your mom, I picked her up. It was in Ithaca, New York. And of course, it was roll up, you know, side windshield. And it didn't work. I had to go over and pull up the window so she wouldn't get cold. And, you know, I think 5 years later, I sold the car for a down payment on her engagement ring. And like you were saying, Scott, it was a very emotional experience.
Yeah.
Very emotional. Whoever got that car, I signed the title over. I couldn't bear it. As I tie it forward, my daughter got married last August. My wife gave her wedding ring. So when I look at my daughter's ring now, I think of that car. That's it never funny. Goes away. Do you guys feel like this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So even the ones you sell?
I sold the car to buy my house. And it
here we go.
Yeah.
But he puts the key in the front door. He's thinking, you know, 68 Chevy or something.
Yeah. I had a 1950 Ford business coupe that my uncle sold to my father, and my father had it restored, and I bought it from him. So when it came time to buy the house and put a down payment on it, I sold the car.
Wow. And what year was that?
That was 1995. Wow. Fortunately for me, I was working with somebody. I'm a mechanic also by trade. At the time, I was working for Calvin Klein. I worked on manufacturing equipment. When you see videos of things filling bottles at high speed, you know, that was my trade.
Wow.
So I was training a fella at work. And at the time, I didn't have a car. And he needed a motor for his car. And it was a rare car with a rare motor. I happen to have the motor in my junk pile. I call it the junk pile, but we call it inventory now.
Yes.
The inventory. I said, well, I could sell you the motor. And he put me in touch with the guy that has my 70 Challenger that I bought. He says, well, I'll take the motor and put you in touch with the guy with the Challenger.
Nice.
Wow.
So it all works like that. Like, we all think the same way, you know? One thing leads to another, to another, to another lead. Maybe down the road we'll find a 68 Mustang, huh, Scott?
Absolutely. I keep my eyes peeled.
I didn't ask your mom about it yet, but I think she gives me carte blanche. If I can replace that car, that would be the way.
It depends on how much work you want to do to it.
Or how much work you want to do to it.
Yeah, or how much work Scott wants to do to it.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of trades and how it's a bit of a dying art. Do you want to talk about what your day-to-day is and, two, the most expensive mistakes you see people making in the shop?
Absolutely. My day starts off at 6 o'clock. I'm on the road, go work on cars at my first job up in Goshen, New York, and then I come back down to Haskell and I work over at another shop in town.
Wow.
Till about, that's part-time, so 3:15 to like 6:30. Then I go home and I work on more cars, which people are probably going to hear this and be like, this guy's crazy. But it's not work for me. I enjoy it, and that's the hard thing, because to do a trade, like, some people love cabinet making. That's for them work. It's not work. You do what you love. You don't work a day in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the way it feels for me. Like, in the trades, a lot of people now, especially my age, they aren't exposed to what they could do. Like, hey, I want to be an electrician, but they have nothing to introduce them. And that's where I think, you know, everybody's told, oh, you have to go to college, you have to this. Not saying that's the wrong way, but for some people, such as myself, I didn't like school. I would always think, oh, what could I be doing outside of school? I can go work on this, go work on that. A lot of people my age now should really consider that, take on one of the trades, because we are in demand. We need more.
Yeah, I mean, even just your day-to-day, it sounds like there is quite a need.
So I'll put us in the same category in this one, Lon. You know, what I know about vehicles is this. Oil changes are important. Tire rotation is important. I try to keep my vehicle clean, but I would say that's the scope of my understanding of a vehicle now.
And that's even like a little beyond me. So
yeah.
We don't even have to be
the same. And one of my pet peeves is I feel that whoever you're paying money to, you should have a relationship with. So I work with a local mechanic.
How many years?
Oh, long time. I can leave my keys. I can leave the vehicle and the keys, and I can tell him basically, here's what I see. Will you go through it? There's two things. One, it's trust. I'm trusting him to tell me what's wrong, if anything. But number two is he's trusting me as well that, you know, I'm going to pay him for his services and I recommend him. And it's kind of a two-way street. And that's what I like about it. What I didn't like is every time I took my car to like a tire shop early on in my life, it was basically I wanted an oil change. And I was always four tires every time I went for an oil change. And I couldn't say, how am I burning through these tires so quickly? Okay. So I sense very intuitively here that you're that type of mechanic.
Absolutely. And the place I work, We're upfront. We're very honest. And that's a hard thing to find because, like you said, I am paying you or they're paying us for service and you have to be honest. You know, we had a vehicle come in one time from another shop and they were same thing like you said with the tires. Every time they're getting stuff that they ain't needed done to the car.
The upsell.
Upsell, absolutely.
Yeah, the upsell.
Outside of that, what are some common expensive mistakes?
Really, it's not wanting to spend the money, which, okay, you have, let's say, an oil leak on your vehicle. Yes, it's going to cost about $1,000 to fix it properly, but do you want the oil keep leaking and maybe run the motor out of oil? Then you need a new motor, which is very expensive. That's probably the biggest. We try and explain everything to everybody like, hey, you need to do this or plan for this. And it's whether they take the advice or don't. For those who don't, they end up either, you know, damaging their vehicles to where they need a lot of repairs or to where you have to get a whole new vehicle.
This is the Grandma Smith. 1 ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure somebody else has said that, but Grandma Smith said it first.
So good. It's so upstate.
It is. So the marketplace right now for vehicles, would you ever gravitate to buying a new car? Do any of the new cars on the market attract your eye?
I bought one.
You did. We have an honest guess there. What did you buy?
Well, my wife, Doreen, was driving a Honda. We're Honda people. I've been driving them since 1984. And Honda's, in my eyes, a very well-engineered vehicle, and I've had tremendous success with them. Low cost to own. You know, they've never left me stranded. But anyhow, back to Doreen's car. She has a Honda Pilot, and we've racked up 235,000 miles on it.
Nice.
It runs terrific. We've done all scheduled maintenance, fluids changes, you know, all that stuff. But I just don't have a good feeling having my wife driving a car with that many miles on it. So I was forced to take the dive. And rather than buy a used car for $30,000, I went and bought a brand new car at our age, Dan. You know, this might be like the last brand new car. I'm 60. You know, we hang on to them.
How far do you plan to?
We're taking it out to your mid-90s here, so, you know.
Well, at some point, Scott's going to be driving us around. Maybe if he has children, his kids will be driving us around in our new Honda CR-V that we just bought. Mm-hmm. But we didn't buy it. I leased it.
You leased it. Okay. Good.
Yeah. Some people are against leasing. It fit the budget. And at the end of the lease, usually Hondas are fantastic cars. We buy it out anyhow.
Great. So
yeah. The residual on the lease was actually fair. If you get into a bad lease deal, they're going to say, okay, Mr. Bracken, myself, give us $500 a month. And then at the end of the lease, you owe us basically what the window sticker is now, today.
Right.
You know,
right.
So the car doesn't appreciate, but you give them $500 a month. It doesn't make sense to me. So the residual on the lease was good. So I went ahead.
See, here's a guy who knows what residual means. That was my first job was I did auto and equipment leasing.
Oh, okay.
So residual means what the vehicle price is at the end of the lease. Residual value.
And the good thing about Hondas and Toyotas is that they hold a good value. When you lease lesser vehicles, we'll just say, at the end of the lease, the car is actually worth less than the buyout.
Oy.
That's called upside down, by the way.
Yes, it is. Excellent.
Upside down.
You don't want that. Upside down, bad.
Since the start of COVID, the whole vehicle market has really, it's in laser viewpoint right now. You know, vehicles are really holding their values right now. Whereas the depreciation of a vehicle, which means the residual values over time in the past would just plummet. You know, I think it's because the cost of new vehicles are so high. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the used market has really had kind of a metamorphosis. Have you seen that?
Absolutely.
So there's nothing wrong with buying a used car.
Not at all.
But I always preface this when I talk to a client. I said, listen, I'm totally fine with you buying a used vehicle, but you need to have a Bracken and Bracken Incorporated here to look at the vehicle. There's a lot of slick willy salesmen out there.
Okay? Absolutely true.
And it's the guts of the vehicle. Are they in good shape as opposed to, you know, the shiny new color of the car? Correct?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Does it matter what kind of gas you put in the car?
Oh, yeah. Great question.
I would say, yes, it does matter what kind of fuel you put
in. I'm thinking it doesn't matter. Okay. So,
and that's how I grew up.
So. Some cars it doesn't, and other cars, Acuras in particular, yep, require premium fuel because it has higher octane.
And it has to go with the way the motor is engineered to run. Like Dad was saying, some vehicles, they're required, they're engineered to run on 93 octane fuel, and people put regular 87 in the vehicle, and it hurts performance, it can damage the motor.
And hurt the mileage.
Absolutely.
Okay. It will actually get better mileage out of the vehicle if you use the higher octane fuel.
So is that something you ask your mechanic about?
Most of the time it says it right on the gas cap on the inside of the door. Use 93 only or, you know, regular.
Look at that.
Exactly. Yep. The other thing I've started to pay more attention to is tire pressure. Like, we're in June. Tire pressure is different in June than it is in December, right?
Absolutely. The molecules, yes. You know, see? You slow down in the cold and you lose tire pressure.
See?
This was a particularly brutal winter. Did you have a lot of business?
For tires, absolutely.
Is there a vehicle that got away for each of you?
I'll let Scott answer my question. Okay. Scott Jr. can answer it.
Okay.
Your 71 Roadrunner still talks about that car.
Yeah, it drove past my house when I was about 11 or 12, and yeah. I heard it rumbling, and I said, wow, that car is really amazing. I love it. And the man lived in my town, and that was his route home from work, so I could expect it to go by almost every day, you know?
Yeah.
And finally, I had turned 19, and I saw it for sale, and I bought it.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, and I sold it, I guess, in like 1990. I had it for a couple of years, but I sold it to buy a newer car.
Right.
And that's when Doreen discovered that it made me cry. When and if I saw the car today, I would do everything I could to purchase it.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
If somebody had your Mustang.
Oh, I would. I'd had the checkbook out immediately. It wouldn't even be a question. I wouldn't let the person leave.
Yeah.
He's done more for less.
I don't care. If I could track that car down somehow, I wish I never wrote down the serial number. Yeah. Scott Daniel?
Yeah, I do not have one that got away.
Because it didn't get away.
No, yeah. I just hung on to it. And same thing, I would do everything that I can do to hang on to it. Before I got my Duster, Dad and I, we went halves on a 69 Roadrunner.
Yep. Yep. He was 12.
What is a Roadrunner? 11. Who makes the Roadrunner?
Oh, I'm sorry. You were 11.
Yes.
11 years old.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
It's a Plymouth.
Plymouth.
Same
okay.
thing. Mopar, Chrysler product. Same thing. Just gravitated towards them.
Of the muscle car era.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
Like muscle car, just explain what a muscle car is. What does that mean?
Well, it started in the mid-60s when the big three were putting cars together, and their belief was win on race day, sell on Monday. So if you had the car with the winning stats at the track, people would come in and buy them. Muscle cars in particular were designed to be at a low price point. So it was a, more or less like a stripped down kind of car, but it had a big horsepower engine
right.
in it, you know, and it had cool graphics and stuff to it. Sporty, but full size sporty.
What's under your perusement? How many vehicles do you have at your location?
Got to count. It's quite a bit.
Let's just call it five.
Something like that.
All right.
But Scott,
a loose five.
Scott is currently working on a 1965 GTO. It was in a barn for 30 years. And a friend of mine, he said, I have to get my GTO out of the barn because I'm losing the storage. Do you want to get it running? I said, sure. I said, I'll ask Scott because he's going to get it running. The man never stops. So I asked Scott if he was on board. He brought it up to the house and Scott's been working on it. And sure enough, we were driving it just the other day, Scott.
That's right.
I'm very proud of you. It's a proud dad moment. This is my, it's not an aha moment, but it's definitely a proud, I mean, I'm proud of my whole family, but just the work that he did on that GTO really impressed me a lot. No doubt.
Absolutely.
You know, I have an uncle, he's Uncle Bob,
yeah.
who still comes up and hangs out with us, and we go hang out with him, and he has an antique car, and he's in a car club and all this, and Scott's girlfriend happens to have an antique car, too.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, she's got a couple of cars, so it's kind of like a lifestyle.
Eat, live, and breathe, honestly.
And I always say you meet the nicest people at car shows.
Really?
Because nobody's really competing. There's no team thing. You know, my team's better than yours. We're going to crush you. It's more like, oh, is your car broke? I'll help you get it going.
Oh,
and you'll see that camaraderie more often at a race event, you know, drag racing or something like that, or a car show. It's just a lifestyle with us.
Yeah, and it's a great way to share your story about the car. People want to hear the story.
So true.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. That, and I look at, a car is a canvas. You can make it anything you want to be. Yeah, it's a form of art in a way.
Agree.
Love that.
Let's end on that, Alana Jacqueline.
Yeah, beautiful.
This is the Scott Bracken and the Scott Daniel Bracken.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I always admire very strong parental and child relationships. Obviously, these are two men now. It's a beautiful thing, whether it's father, son, father, daughter, mom, son, mother, daughter. The fact that they share something that they're both so passionate about.
Yeah, you could just feel how positive they were. They could have talked for hours. We could have talked to them for hours. They were like so excited to get out after the recording. Go do it.
Exactly. You know, like my dad and I had the baseball thing. That was our commonality.
And we happen to have a podcast.
Exactly. And they were so excited to do this. I'm sure the listeners are going to feel that.
Yeah. So we just want to wish everyone a happy Father's Day out there.
Yes. And can your bonds with your dads be as strong as Scott Daniels is with his dad?
And as mine and my dad are sitting on this couch in my childhood bedroom turned podcast studio.
And we're standing at the Illuminate sign, Dan Has a Plan.
And he does.
Did you ever think that we'd be doing this in your old stomping grounds here?
Don't ask me. Did you ever think?
It's good though.
Well, happy Father's Day, Dad.
Thank you. And it's an honor to be your dad.
Honor to be your daughter.
And I love you.
I love you too.
Presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.